Right now, of course, we're trying to get our special guest for the evening, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we're really so fortunate to have Dr. Cuddy. Dr. Cuddy is one of the world's, I would say he is probably, at the present time, the world's leading historical researcher on what's going on in the world today. And he's done a number of phenomenal studies on the background of education. In fact, he's a professional educator, worked for the Department of Education at one time. But now, of course, he is researching such things as the New World Order. And we're going to be talking about the background of the New World Order. You know, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh belittles and puts down and calls anybody who talks about the move towards world government or the New World Order an extremist right-wing kook. And yet Rush Limbaugh knows that they've moved towards the New World Order. But I always say that Rush is intelligent, articulate, funny, and he's the best conservative that money can buy. Dr. Cuddy, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for being with us this evening. And we're just going to talk a little bit about, the New World Order. And there's so much documentation out there. I mean, these people have been talking about it for years, and yet there's this conscious effort to allay the apprehension of the American people and not to let them understand there really is a move towards world government. Would you sort of like to pick up and tell the story of this move towards world government, where it came from and where it's going?
Well, let me do a little something different tonight. There's various aspects, but we had talked about was a lot of people see this strictly in terms of political or economic concerns, but there's also today you would say a movement towards a one world religion, which a lot of people believe will have a New Age element, but even that has a historical background. And so I'll just as quickly as possible go through some of this background. A good starting point would be about 1,000 years ago when the Knights Templar were formed. And I won't spend too much time on them, but they were the political and economic power of the day. They got European sovereigns in their debt. And finally, Philip, the King of France, Philip IV, Philip the Fair, as he was known, along with the Pope, decided it was time for the Templars to be gone, because not only were they an economic and political power, but they were getting into Eastern mysticism, Gnosticism, introducing homosexuality into the order, and there was a certain spiritual dimension to what the Templars were about. And so Jacques de Molay, this would be the Masonic Youth Group, is named after him today, was executed in the early 1300s, and many people said, well, the Templars died, but there was another theory that they, the remnant of them went underground, they went to England, Scotland, and so forth, and in fact, there's a list in a 1907 book called The Illustrated History of Freemasonry that brings the Grand Masters all the way up to someone named Admiral, because he was head of the British Navy, an Admiral William Smith. William Sidney Smith in 1838. He had received the Templar Cross from a Greek archbishop and was establishing his central power. He wanted it to be in Malta, actually, at that time. Now, the reason I'm bringing that up is a number of people would belong to that, one of whom was the uncle of Alfred Lord Tennyson, who, in a poem called Locksley Hall, was talking about the Parliament of Man and the Federation of the World. And why that's as important is that in the 1800s, there was not only individuals like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, who were transcendentalists, this sort of spiritualism element, but they would also meet in the Midwest and see how they can form a world government at that time. And there are other people doing the same thing. The Baha'u'llah, head of the Baha'i faith in the mid-1800s, was talking about a one-world government and a one-world religion at the same time. Well, a lot of these people were not only one-worlders in an economic or political sense, but also in a spiritual sense, so that they would form a couple of decades later what was called the Society for Psychical Research. Now, your listener's general impression of that is that this is probably a small group of weird people just having a bunch of seances. But actually, what you find is that people like Lord Tennyson himself, along with John Ruskin, who had a swastika on his grave, and who was the mentor, more or less, of Cecil Rhodes, who had a conspiracy for a one-world government, were members of the societies, along with British prime ministers like William Gladstone and Arthur Balfour. You have the father of American psychology, William James, was a member of that, along with, he was also a graduate of Wilhelm Wundt's Leipzig University. That has a whole history to it.
Now, was Tennyson actually a member of that Society for Psychical Research?
Oh, yes.
That's such an important fact.
William James, that was founded around 1882,
right.
And then 3 years later, William James founded the American Society of Psychical Research. But other individuals of note, Lewis Carroll, who wrote the Alice in Wonderland series, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a physician and author of Sherlock Holmes.
And he was a disciple of Madame Blavatsky's, wasn't he?
Yes, they were members of the Society of Psychical Research, along with the founders of the Fabian Society, Frank Podmore and Edward Peace, were members of this group. You'll also have a connection with the political and economic in this sense. There was an intermarrying, a lot of intermarrying. The Balfours would intermarry with his sister would marry a Professor Henry Sidgwick, which was part of the Cecil Rhodes group, and Sidgwick's sister Mary, was her name, married Edward White Benson, who became the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they had the son Robert Hugh Benson, and your listeners may remember he wrote the book Lord of the World in 1907, where he was projecting 100 years down the road about communism and so forth. And you would have corresponding members to this society, such as a Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung were corresponding members of this group. So it's not some, you know, some weird, isolated non-entities. And then, of course, when the American Society formed, you would have people like David Starr Jordan, the founder of the Sierra Club, John Dewey, Clarence Darrow, the attorney at the Scopes Monkey Trial, Theodore Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, who was also a member of Skull and Bones. Some big-name people were involved in this group.
And, of course, Clarence Darrow was a founder or part of the socialist movement here with the League for Industrial Democracy.
Just like John Dewey.
And so we see this interplay then, this intertwining of these so-called socialists who most people think are atheists, but they are really, dabbling in the occult as well.
Yes, so it's not only a political and economic element, but a spiritualistic or occultic element as well, which would come on up to today into what generally is called the New Age. I mean, since you mentioned theosophical, remember Hitler got his swastika, which is also the emblem on Rudyard Kipling's books, if you look at his early books, of this sort of elite, and it's a spiritualistic elite, not just a political and economic elite, but with Blavatsky and her individuals, there was this, her various works. She actually, in addition to The Secret Doctrine and works like that, she would have a magazine called Lucifer, and later on you would have the Lucifer Publishing Company being the publisher of Alice Bailey's works, and Alice Bailey talks about points of light connected to service and a new world order. She actually used those terms, and of course your listeners will remember that President Bush would later on use those terms, and people would say, well, so what, is a coincidence? But actually, briefly, in talking about the New Age today, you have a leader called Dorothy Maver of the Seven Ray Institute, and you say, okay, another weird person. No, she's also taught at Keene College in New Jersey, and she delivered an address back in October of 90 where she specifically referred to President Bush implementing the Points of Light Initiative about service and group work, and then she concluded by saying, again, quote, again, we can identify and recognize the esoteric connection in this. So they're fully aware of this, and then you may remember Jack Anderson, the columnist. His assistant, Ron McRae, published a book called Mind Wars, where they're specifically going into how George Bush facilitated through the CIA parapsychology in 1976, with Edgar Mitchell, his personal friend, and Mitchell's Institute of Noetic Sciences, and how they were discussing how the CIA could use possible intelligence applications of parapsychology, and the whole Barbara Marx Hubbard New Age routine with her Delta Force psychology and the First Earth Battalion, and their motto was, I take personal responsibility for generating evolutionary conspiracies. I mean, there's a whole connection here.
Well, of course, they understand that, but of course they attack anybody, who ever speaks of it. In fact, most of the people who talk about the New World Order never mention the spiritual aspect behind it. And yet that's the common denominator that ties it all together.
Yes. In fact, when Cecil Rhodes, who I mentioned earlier, had his secret society, the Society of the Elect, Kipling, for example, was a member of the Rhodes Trust. Okay, and what was critical to them is they had three elements. They had what was called the Cecil Bloc, Lord Cecil, and that was the political influence behind Lord Alfred Milner's furtherance of Rhodes' plan. The economic part was his Society of the Elect, and then there was an intellectual influence provided by the Toynbee Group, what was called the Toynbee Group. And this is Arnold Toynbee, the famous historian. And Toynbee, 40 years after Rhodes had formed his society, was delivering a speech over in Copenhagen. And he said, I'll just use a brief quote here. He says, "We are present working discreetly with all our might to wrest this mysterious force called sovereignty out of the clutches of the local nation states. All the time we are denying with our lips what we are doing with our hands." And he goes on, in effect, what they're saying is we're going to lie about this.
Sure. Well, everything is a lie, and of course they have so many people working for them in the media who are covering for them, because the last thing they want the American people, or the people of Europe, to know is that this is part of a plan to take away their freedom and place the power, place the ability to rule in the hands of this this group of elitists who believe that they, and they alone, have the capacity to rule mankind.
That's right, and somebody may be saying, okay, so what's that got to do with the Society of Psychical Research? Well, the point is, the Cecil Bloc, that particular political element, included not only Kipling and Lord Tennyson and Balfour and Gladstone, but also people like T.H. Thomas Huxley, who was, in effect, Darwin's bulldog, and evolution was a key part of this. But if you look at Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown, Professor Quigley, in his smaller book, The Anglo-American Establishment, he says, this is a quote, "One of the enduring creations of the Cecil Bloc is the Society for Psychical Research. In the 20th century, it was dominated by those members of the Cecil Bloc who became most readily members of the Milner Group. Dame Edith Littleton, herself a Balfour, was president of this society in 1933-34.
And I think that is probably one of the most significant things in that that book, The Anglo-American Establishment. And I'm not sure that Quigley really understood the spiritual aspect of,
no,
of what he had uncovered.
No, and he, for whatever reason, didn't pick up on the long-range plan of bringing this all together. And that's the key. Most people see these as disparate elements. But, for example, William James, who I mentioned, the founder of American psychology, the father, was also the founder of the American Society for Psychical Research. Well, if you look back at his old books, like The Principles of Psychology in 1890, he's describing there a young child's impressions in this manner. He says, this is a quote, short one, "The baby, assailed by eyes, ears, nose, skin, and entrails at once, feels it all as one great, blooming, buzzing confusion," end quote. Then he goes on and explains, "All the sensations which came to our notice at once coalesced together in one and the same space." Now, what's that got to do with anything? Well, what that has to do is when Richard Gardner, who was a Rhodes Scholar, wrote to CFR member, trilateralist, Bill Clinton advisor on the UN, the whole bit. When he wrote that article in Foreign Affairs, the CFR's magazine of 74, not only did he talk about the House of World Order and eroding national sovereignty piece by piece, as most of your listeners are familiar, but he also referred to it specifically in term, and he said, William James's famous description of a blooming, buzzing confusion.
Oh, I see. So,
and then he went on and described how GATT would be part of this erosion. So what he was doing was saying, look, we got this world government element, we have this GATT world economic element, and what we're going to do is bring all these disparate elements together in one coalescing final world system, which will involve everything, world economics, world politics, world religion, the whole bit.
And, you know, what's really so interesting is that there's this small group that understand, and they've read one another's writings, and they understand their significance. In fact, I don't know if you ever read that article by Arthur Schlesinger in October of 1993 in the Wall Street Journal,
yes,
where he quoted Tennyson's poem, and,
right.
you know, about the New World Order, and then said, you know, we're never going to have a New World Order without paying for it in blood as well as with money.
That's right, and it's not only a leap from way back up to now, but Harry Truman said this. He says, Harry Truman carried that particular phrase from Tennyson's poem around in his pocket, and he says, this is what I have been trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and, of course, you know, Winston Churchill said those are the most noble words ever written. But, of course, Winston Churchill had been actually recruited into the Druids. He was a Mason. Harry Truman was a Mason. They were all dedicated to this idea of the one-world government, which at least the upper echelons of Masonry has always been dedicated to since the days of the Templars.
And so was Madame Blavatsky,
right.
along with Annie Besant, who succeeded her.
As well as the communists and the socialists and the humanists and the CFR and the trilateralists and the Bilderbergers, they all want world government.
That's right. That's right. And the spiritual element is important in this because, for example, Gene Houston, the shaman sort of quote-unquote New Age person who was at the White House with Hillary, she has been, I don't think she still is, maybe she's too big for him, but she was a member of the American Society for Psychical Research. And you recall that at the White House, she didn't just say, now what, Hillary, would Eleanor Roosevelt think about this? She actually asked Hillary to visualize meeting
right.
Eleanor and then asked Hillary to play the part of and speak as Mrs. Roosevelt. And this is part of what Jean Houston and her New Age types, who developed what was called the Witch's Cradle, called achieving your potential godhood, which is a typical aspect of the New Age today.
It really is so fascinating because once you understand the spiritual, you can see it all put together. And yet, you know, if you look at all these individual little pieces, they're like pieces of the puzzle and they don't mean anything. It's only when they come together with this understanding that it's all energized by these dark, and I personally believe they're Luciferian forces, does it really take on its proper dimension. And do you look upon this as Luciferian?
Well, what I try to do is I separate myself from what they would say. Now, if ultimately, biblically, all of this Antichrist eventuality is behind it is satanic mechanisms. If you look at it from a purely biblical perspective, it's
right.
the good versus the bad and so forth. If you, for example, however, went up to somebody, let's say like Al Gore, and it said, are you Luciferian? He would probably say no. You know, I'm not. I go to the Episcopal or Baptist or whatever it is, church. However, what's interesting about that is if you then say, well, do you have New Age beliefs? He may, in fact, say yes, because not only in his Earth and the Balance is he, you know, emphasizing the Mother Gaia concept there and speaking very positively of it around midway in the book, but to those people who say they don't believe in conspiracies, Al Gore, several years ago with Congressional Clearinghouse on the Future, of which he was an officer, made a very, very pointed endorsement and promotion of Marilyn Ferguson's book, The Aquarian Conspiracy.
Yes, in fact, wasn't Newt Gingrich also a member of that same little,
yes.
little select group? And, of
yes.
course, most Americans think he's a conservative. That's the most incredible thing.
Yes, they have that impression of Newt, but what you have to remember is that he's been very close to the Tofflers, and in their late book that was published by Newt's organization originally, now they got another publisher, they were in there talking about we have to junk the current Constitution and we can't go back to the values of the 1950s, the Ozzie and Harriet values, they call them. So Newt is rather questionable when it comes to various moral aspects.
No, not only moral, but, you know, being associated with the Tofflers who believe that the Constitution has to be done away with and the Bill of Rights has to be done away with.
Well, he also supports NAFTA and GATT and
sure.
all of that as well.
And then, of course, once in a while, he'll come out and oppose Bill Clinton and makes it look good. It's sort of like, it would remind me of sort of Laurel and Hardy. They put on a great show, always fighting back and forth.
Yeah, the good cop, bad
right.
cop routine.
But they're both cops. Well, you know, this is a fascinating analysis of what's going on. And, of course, that information on the Society for Psychical Research, to me, I mean, I came across that in Professor Quigley's book, and it was just sort of, it was like a light went on. We hadn't talked about it before, you know, I'd actually come to that. Did I ever send you a copy of my Brotherhood of Darkness video?
No.
Well, I suppose it's probably in the mail. I think I wrote down to send you one, but I think you'll find we've covered a lot of these things that you've talked about tonight. Nowhere near as well as you have, however. I had no idea that Tennyson was part of this movement.
Yes. Well, also, the impression, like I said, not only back in the 1800s, is that these are a few wacky people who are out there and no serious threat. Is even when you talk about today, not only is a Dorothy Maver, who I have this occultic tape where she's doing some weird things over in Australia, is into this, and yet also received at Keene College, but you'll have Fintorn community where actually Peter and Eileen Caddy set it up, but you'll have a person like Dorothy McLean out there, who's a former British intelligence officer, saying she's got to talk to the peas and carrots before she eats them so they'll understand what she's doing. It's like Al Gore going out and hug a tree, things like that. Then you have a book which is a very good, if your listeners want to get a good synopsis of today and how the spiritual element is involved in what's going on. There's a book called Spiritual Politics by Corinne McLaughlin. And Gordon Davidson has a foreword by the Dalai Lama in there as referring to the Aquarian conspiracy and so on. And so you say, well, who are these people? Well, they're with this what's called the Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S, community. This is one of these intentional communities. And the impression would be, okay, this is another wacky group. But actually, they teach transformational politics at American University in Washington, D.C., so on the one hand, you'll say, well, this is a little far out, but on the other hand, these people have very prominent positions. If you look at, let's say, the area of education, for example, there's an individual who's at one of our federally funded labs and centers, which when I was with the federal government, we put up some money for these people. And they're the ones, even though the federal budget is only like 7% of the total education expenditures, this is where a lot of your curriculum development, what the youngsters are actually taught, happens. And one of these places was called the Mid-Continent Regional Lab. It's out in the Midwest. It has a couple of offices, one's in Kansas and one's in Colorado. But a senior person there was an individual who is, well, her name is Shirley McCune, not McLean. She's another New Age actress, but this one is Shirley McCune. And years ago, she would be working with a psychologist involved with the National Training Laboratories. She knows Jean Houston. And she would, maybe 20 years ago, develop a paper about 60-some pages for the Kansas Department of Education. And what she was explaining there and pointing out is pretty much what we have today, sort of your school-to-work goals 2000 background. And she would go around and make speeches and be recognized at governor's conferences and so on. Well, lo and behold, a couple of years ago, she comes out with a book called The Light Shall Set You Free, which is typical theosophical. And in there she says, well, we've got to have this new curriculum. And by the way, I'm getting it from these ascended masters. And they're the same ones that the Annie Besants and the Alice Baileys and the Blavatskys, some of them were getting their stuff from. And did you know that your children's souls were formerly the souls of animals, and we've all got to become androgynous in the future? And this is a prominent educator. She's now, I believe, currently the assistant to the superintendent of the state of Washington.
Now, you know, could you just briefly cover what the ancient masters and masters of wisdom are, because some of these phrases, if we have, you know, new listeners, they may not have any idea what you're talking about. What's a master of wisdom?
Well, Blavatsky initially was accepted for what she was doing. Actually, she, I think, plagiarized a lot of this stuff from Eliphas Levi 100 years before she was around, but she had been fighting with Garibaldi and a bunch of revolutionaries, and eventually in the late 1870s set up the Theosophical Society and wrote Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine, and supposedly she was getting telepathic communications from these ascended masters named Kut Humi and Joal Kul and individuals like that, who are these spirits.
And these are really demons.
The words from these people who are ancient and sometimes reincarnated embodiments, and the Buddha of today and the Christ consciousness and so forth.
Well, these are really basically demonic spirits
yes.
who were
yes.
channeling these ideas to
That's
her.
That's right.
Right. So I think that our listeners have to understand that these are demonic spirits who were really possessing her and then helping her to write the... if you ever tried to read the Secret Doctrine, I'm not very good at Sanskrit and some of these other things. It's got so much in there that is so... You mean, the average individual would need 13 college degrees to read it.
That's right. And also, when some people say, well, I need to get into this and research it, what you have to be mindful about is you don't really want to get into that stuff too much because
you sure don't.
What goes into your mind sort of sits in there, even though you may push it to the back. And you want to keep a lot of this occultic stuff out of your mind.
Because it can possess you as well, simply through the written word.
Well, yeah, that's right. In fact, there's a biblical passage, I forget whether it's Peter or Paul or whatever they're referring to exactly, but a disciple is out there and they're trying to convince and convert somebody, and they're acting a little bit arrogant, as it was, and these demonic spirits say, well, we know Peter and Paul, but who are you? And then they go beat him up.
Served him right.
Yeah.
But anyway, you were talking about, you know, Madame Blavatsky and really, so she really started this whole thing, at least. She's the one we ordinarily point at. And then, of course, from her it was Annie Besant and then Alice Bailey but, of course, Alice Bailey was talking about the points of light and the New World Order. In fact, in that book, Spiritual Politics, they actually talked about Alice Bailey and making those statements and then George Bush repeating them.
Right. It's Points of Light connected to service. Alice would talk about her new group of world servers, which we have today, and she mapped out, you know, the plans over the decades and said the final thing would be completed by around the year 2025, thereabouts, and it would all coalesce, just like we mentioned before, the world government, the world economy, the world religion, all at once. And so, for example, with the world religion, one of the groups that are trying to bring that... about today, the sort of one world initiative, it's interesting how these things coalesce, as we said, would be an individual named Bishop Swing out in California. And when you look at the Presidio, who is this Gorbachev Foundation, had taken over the former military base in San Francisco as what's called the Presidio Trust. And not only there in the Presidio Trust are part of the Gorbachev Foundation, but you have a whole list, including, of all things, the Thoreau, remember Henry David Thoreau's
sure.
center. So you have your United Religions Initiative, as it's called, the Movement Toward One World Religion, and the initiative is more or less the leader would be Bishop Swing, but there are others. You have the Gorbachev Foundation, and then you have the Thoreau Center, and the Gorbachev's his effort is called the State of the World Forum that's there, and you have a whole lot of other organizations out there, the Tide Center, the Threshold Foundation, but it's a real collection, so that you have a Gorbachev Center, which involves politics, but also a certain amount of spirituality. You have the Thoreau Center, which is really getting into the spirituality, and you have the United Religions Initiative, which wants definitely a one-world religion.
And, of course, San Francisco is also a center of homosexuality, and I don't
right.
think it's all just accidental. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and one of our favorite guests. And I really want to get back right into this idea of Gorbachev. I mean, why Gorbachev has received such a warm welcome in the West, and why this man is today one of the most powerful men in the world, and yet nobody ever mentions he used to be in charge of the professional assassinations right there, and the KGB came up through the KGB, the Murder Incorporated, that killed people and terrorized people and tortured people. But let's go to Mike here first, and then we'll get into Gorby. Does he have a question, Mike?
Well, a question and a comment, if I could. First, I just wanted to speak in support of what Dr. Cuddy is saying, and I'm speaking as a person who is submerged in the philosophies he's describing for nearly two decades of my life.
Right.
Prior to coming to the knowledge of the Word of God 12 years ago. And so I really value this kind of program tonight. I want to ask Dr. Cuddy, he was speaking about the swastika a while ago. And I'd like to know if if he has any idea why the key to the city of Seattle would, the design of it, include the swastika.
Have you ever heard that, Dr. Cuddy?
You know, the swastika is down where the teeth are that turn the tumblers in the locks. And it's a swastika there.
No, I didn't know that. And if you could somehow, either through a photograph or brochure, send that to Dr. Stan, I'd be interested in seeing
it. I have a photograph of it.
Think of.
I have a photograph of it. And
well, you get it to me, Mike, and
yeah.
You'll get it to Dr. Cuddy, because he's got more of these things than anybody else in the world. And,
uh-huh.
Okay, thanks.
Well,
anything else?
Well, I just wanted to say just another word. It was given to Rear Admiral Charles Sperry in 1908. For anybody listening who's curious, there it is.
Okay.
The key right now is in the U.S. Naval Academy Museum.
Will you get us? Can you get us a copy of it? Or a copy of a picture?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks so much,
okay.
Mike.
Okay.
Bye bye.
And
of course, I know
just
Mike.
Offer an explanation of that, if I could, since he brought up 1908. What you have is the swastika. In fact, there was an article about in Fame magazine that was talking about these youngsters who had gotten into the Skull and Bones vault there at Yale, and they said there's a bunch of swastikas in there. It's like some sort of Nazi iconic symbolism altar or something they were describing it as, and somebody, they said, should ask President Bush about that. What you had back in the 1800s was this sort of Teutonic Aryan race philosophy developing, and you would have the what's called the runes, and this is where the SS symbol and all of that comes from. And it's an elitist core. Skull and Bones came from about 1832, a Germanic university core. And if you challenge people today in the New Age that individuals like Blavatsky would have it, they'd say, oh, well, you know, the swastika arm bent to the left, however, and that meant it was just a religious type of symbol, and the Nazis were to the right. Well, actually, Goring's, I think, went to the left as well. However, at this time, it was not only people like Ruskin, Cecil Rhodes' mentor, who has a swastika on his grave, but Rudyard Kipling, as I said, if you look at his early books before 1900, there's the swastika as well. But in terms of this admiral that your caller mentioned in the city of Seattle, I was looking at the directory, the city directory in a city where I live, and there was this big ad for what was called Citizens National Bank. And right in the middle of it is a swastika. It's an upside-down triangle with a swastika in the middle, and this is from 1923-24. It's before Hitler really got strong, and there's the swastika as a symbol.
You know, the interesting thing is that they put these symbols every place, and most people just don't even have any idea. I mean, they don't recognize the occult symbol on the back of our dollar bill. I mean, the occult symbols are everywhere. The whole design of Washington, D.C. is laid out in parts of it in very occult symbology. And yet, by putting it right out of the open, it's totally concealed because people aren't looking for it, and people would find it impossible to believe that, you know, that these things could really be going on, that there are these dark spiritual forces at work in our society.
Oh, yeah. When Hitler, I mean, it wasn't just Blavatsky. He had a couple of mentors. Guido von Liszt and George Lanz, and they believed that there was this like hidden elect or elite class of what they call priest rulers. Arminen was the name of the group, and Lanz, he blended what you would call Aryan occultism with eugenics. And in 1907, he formed an order of the New Templars, and that's why I originally started with the Knights Templar. And they had as their purpose a sort of harmonization of science, art, and ethics into an occult religion that was devoted to the purification of an Aryan race, which would have psychic powers. And that was the origin of Hitler's SS. And so they blend this psychical research of science with an art and an ethics and the occultism, and they wrapped it all up. But part of it also, remember, was the eugenics part. So a leader for Hitler's Third Reich was Ernst Rudin.
Right.
And he would have articles in Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger's Birth Control Review,
right,
where they're talking about the need for eugenics.
And, of course, you know, one of the interesting things about that book you mentioned earlier, Spiritual Politics by Corrine McLaughlin and Davidson, was that they talked about Winston Churchill, and he insisted that at the Nuremberg trials, the occultism which explained the cruelty and the total inhumanity of Nazism, that never be brought up. And so it was never brought up. And most people don't understand that Nazism had nothing to do with Christianity, or it really had nothing to do with Germany. It had to do with occultism and these occultic concepts and Teutonic concepts that you're speaking of.
Right, and today we, as you mentioned about Gorby, we come up to Gorbachev. He used to take, I think it was called radon baths. He and his wife over there, and they were a real crew. But anyway, in terms of today and Al Gore, you find Gorbachev in charge of the International Green Cross, and he and Maurice Strong are supposed to come up with this Earth Charter,
right?
Which is what Gore is into. And there's a part of this whole element of Mother Gaia and how they'll bring about this world religion and politics and economics is through the environmental movement. So if your readers are interested in the book that blends all of that together, there's one by Michael Kaufman called Saviors of the Earth, and there's an actual chapter in there, Gaia and the World of Mysticism, where he goes into this connection of all of these today.
And it really, this is the common denominator, and that's the only way you can understand environmentalism is not that it has anything to do with trying to save the environment of the trees or the animals or the flora, fauna. It really is because if you read the, I don't know if you had a chance to read the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report, but they talk about how we're all one and really how we have to be concerned about the animals because we are part of them and they're part of us. And we really, man is really no better than the animals.
Right, and the key down the road, since you mentioned about driver's licenses and fingerprints and so on, is being able to track people, and there's like two or three things going on there. If your readers look at the recent, just a few days ago, the July 20th New York Times, there's an article in there, I think it's on the front page, where the writer says the Clinton administration is quietly laying plans to assign every American a unique health identifier, a computer code that could be used to create a national database that would track every citizen's medical history from cradle to grave.
Isn't that nice? I'm sure glad Bill's interested in you and I.
Well, and it gets
or controlling you and I.
It gets even worse, actually, because when you talk about the monitoring, and people say, oh, well, yes, we've got this tracking the deadbeat dads, and this is all, you know, in the infant stages. Well, no, actually, it's not. There's a system that's been around for several years, and it's on the Internet called PROMIS, P-R-O-M-I-S, and it went back to the what is called the INS Law Affair, which stood for the Institute for Law and Social Research. And that was actually in a congressional investigative committee that your listeners can pull off the Internet. The chairman was Representative Jack Brooks, and the date was September 10th of 92 when they finally had the hearings. And it included sworn statements by FBI agents and so on that these individuals and this network was actually sold to foreign intelligence services, and they can literally track, you know, just about whatever you want. So that there was testimony and affidavit, I believe, by Ari Ben Menashe, who is the person who's, you know, blew the whistle on the Iran-Contra and so on, former Israeli intelligence agent who was Yitzhak Shamir's security advisor for about a dozen years. And he had an interview in a Nexus magazine back in February, March of 93, where he said this can, quote, essentially get everything about anybody you want to know, a written record of all telephone numbers anybody has dialed. He goes on and says, I mean, this is the biggest infringement of privacy on anybody or anything. And he said it makes George Orwell's 1984 look modest. He says, once you have this technology and you know everything everybody's doing or whoever you want to follow, you basically control other people that way, and they have access to all of this. This is why a lot of countries love the idea of ID cards, and that's what you were mentioning, because this way it makes things easier. It's governments and bureaucracies trying to control everybody's lives. So there's three or four systems here, this unique health identifier the Clintons are coming up with, and this promise system that has been around for, you know, over a decade.
Well, of course, the promise, as part of the promise, was it was used by banks compiling all the information, but there was a trap door in it so that they could get into and analyze anything that was in there. In other words, you thought that you had a closed system, but there was a vehicle getting into it.
And
there were even vehicles for getting into when you people, you know, sign onto the internet and start, you know, getting some sort of a program off there. There are vehicles by which they can read your hard disk and know everything you've got on there. And of course, we have no privacy at all because they want to know and regulate and control every human being in the world today. I was reading something in the Wall Street Journal about these satellites that they have that monitor everything down to the square meter. And recently the government said that they couldn't do that in Israel anymore because Israel was afraid that those photographs would be sent to other countries, pardon me, to their enemies. But they're monitoring right here in the United States all the time. In fact, they're even monitoring to make sure you haven't added onto your house without a permit, because if you have, then the Planning Commission will know. The frightening things that the technology we've developed in the name of fighting communism is really developed to control the American populace and the populace of the world. Would you agree with that or not?
Sure. And if you play one side against, you know, the good cop, bad cop, then what you find is the alleged demise of the Soviet Union, supposedly, and this allows them to decrease our weapon systems and defenses. But then just a few days ago, I think around July 8th, we have this defector, Stanislav Lunev, who comes out, and I think he has a new book. He was a colonel with the GRU, which is their military intelligence agency, and he said, look, Russia is still training anti-American terrorists for Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria. They have a plan for poisoning America's water supply, hiding terrorist arms caches in U.S. soil. They have American leaders targeted for assassination. They got their spies in congressional offices and the military and newspapers. And this thing is far from over. It reminds me of Dmitry Manuelsky back in the 30s saying we will have the most theatrical peace offensive the world has ever seen. And then once you are lulled into sleep, the bourgeoisie then will be able to strike rather hard. And mentioning that, I thought, I was going back to like Pavlov, you know, with his dogs. And the little bell rings and the dog goes over and punches a button with his paw or something and his little food pellet comes out. And it's very similar to today when you try to talk about these things with the American public. They don't pick up on it. What they do is they go over with their hand and they punch the TV button and get their daily Pavlovian dose of soap operas that conditions them for, you know, their pleasure for the day, their pleasure pill or pellet, whatever.
And of course, the other thing was that Pavlov would, condition the dogs to salivate with a bell, and then with a buzzer, and then with a gong, and then he'd play them all together, and the dog would go mad. In other words, the dog would just go over and hide in the corner because he didn't know how to respond anymore. And sometimes I almost think that's what's happened to the American people. They're incapable of facing the horror of the reality of what's going on today. So they just say it isn't true, and anybody who talks about it is some sort of a kook.
Well, that's I'm glad you brought that up because it fits with what Tavistock later, I think, as Fred Emery was his name, one of the senior researchers of Tavistock, which is had been set up through Rockefeller funding to put wartime psychology into use in the civilian population. He developed what's called the theory of social turbulence, and what that said was you would have a sort of chaos, and what you do is through a series of crises you would confront people. And they would either shrink back and adapt and offer no resistance, or they would adjust and go along with you. But either way, they could care less. You know, either way, you were controlled. And I've seen that a number of times in what I would call leftist religious outfits. I would be talking to some pastor who is a leftist, and he would immediately have blurt out some sort of emotional thing like, you've got to hang up, you know, something like that. And it just happened too much, too often, with too many people. And basically what they were doing was getting me to sort of back down and cower and accept it, or say, I've had enough of this and I'm going to retreat, or, you know, meaning leave that particular church or whatever. And they didn't really care. Either way, I was no longer a problem. I'd either go along with them or I would just divorce myself. And so There's a certain psychology to what you were just talking about that's at play today in this creating this social turbulence. So Americans are confronted with these crises or psychological threats, and they often retreat to themselves or to their soap operas or to their sports, and they no longer become involved, and therefore they rationalize there really is no problem, they're in denial, there is no conspiracy, there's no control. Why? Well, I've got my football game. You know, what could be better?
And, of course, they keep us entertained. They keep us happy with welfare or with the stock market going up or all the benefits that we have now as we're able to buy all of these wonderful things from communist China and Malaysia and South America at such low prices. But, of course, you know, in the end, everything will be lost unless the American people wake up. And, of course, I personally believe unless the American people turn back to God, there is no hope for America.
Well, that's what Weishaupt was doing. If you look at John Robison's Proofs of Conspiracy back a couple hundred years ago, Weishaupt, the head of the Illuminati at the time, with their code names, and Wilhelm Wundt, who I mentioned earlier, his grandfather's code name was Raphael, as part of that group. This is what Weishaupt said. He said, we will delude them with kindness and compassion and friendship and take over their schools. But then he says, once we've got control, we'll come down and smash them.
And well, of course, that's what Manilowski said in the 30s, of course,
right.
From the communist point of view.
As well, they said, we move slow, but then we'll strike hard and fast at the end.
Well, now, what do you think happened to the Illuminati? We know, at least according to the talk that Timothy Dwight gave in July 4th, 1798, and he was the great-grandson of Jonathan Edwards, I understand.
Right.
But he talked about the influence of the Illuminati in the United States in 1798. Did it come here within the structure of Masonry and then diffuse through the upper echelons of Masonry? What do you think actually happened to the Illuminati?
The Illuminati in Bavaria after 3 years supposedly was discovered and so forth, and what happened was a lot of them dispersed. And in Europe, they would go to the Parisian Outlaws League, which then became involved with the French Revolution, and Masonry played a big part in that. And then they would later become the League of the Just.
Oh, that were the people then who commissioned Karl Marx.
Right, and they would have various other elements. Through the Masonic entity, I believe they would come over here and perhaps places like the Columbian Lodge in New York, where DeWitt Clinton was involved, because you hear some of the same language. In the U.S., there was this controversy. George Washington would write a letter to somebody who was talking about them in the Robinson's book, and he said, oh, yes, I know this is a force, and, you know, it's horrible. But on the other hand, Thomas Jefferson was defending Adam Weishaupt as just some sort of philanthropist. He didn't
see
anything wrong with him.
Well, but don't you think there was a lot of difference between Jefferson, who was really a deist and really sympathized with the World Revolutionary Movement, and Washington, who was, although he was a Mason, he was probably still a very devout Christian, because Masonry, when he joined it, certainly did not have the occult overtones that came in towards the end of that century.
Oh, yeah. In fact, they would have arguments, or indirect arguments. I remember Washington, I think, in his inaugural address, he was indirectly referring to Jefferson when he said, look, you've got to have religion, not just some sort of morality. And then he said, which is the province of some peculiar minds. I think he's referring to Jefferson that. He said, you just can't have this humanistic morality that people like Jefferson have. You really have to have religion, and his Christianity was coming there.
Well, we know that, for instance, when Albert Pike wrote his book in 1871, I think it was, Morals and Dogma, he talked about, you know, how you know, you have the Illuminati and Masonry and alchemy, all of these forces were working behind the scenes or had worked behind the scenes. Do you think that the Illuminati then has existed in the upper echelons of the occult movement here, or do you think it's changed its name? Certainly the objectives of what's going on is exactly the same, the destruction of civilization and Christianity.
What I generally say when people say, well, you can't track the Masons or whoever, I said, look, it's really irrelevant. It doesn't matter that Buonarroti didn't come over at midnight some night and get some secret papers from Babeuf, who wrote The Conspiracy of Equality in the French Revolution. The point is, Buonarroti knew about Babeuf. When you talk about Marx and Engels, they were going to reprint a German edition of Buonarroti. So these people have a philosophical and psychological connection to each other. They're very familiar, and whether you call them Illuminati or whatever you call them today, New Age or whatever it is, there's what I generally refer to as a power elite, and their idea is a one-world system, and it will include not only politics and economics, but a one-world religion. They can't leave anything loose.
And, of course, a lot of that's covered in the book Fire in the Minds of Men. Is there any other good source that you can think of, any better source than James H. Billington's book on that subject?
Well, Billington is very good because not only is the Librarian of Congress, but he's a Rhodes Scholar. And he goes into very well the secret societies. Of course, you got to watch Billington because a few years after that, around 1992-ish, he wrote, it's in your public libraries, a book about the Soviet Union in which he's joking about I think one of the leading art directors in Russia. He's having a dinner with him, and he says, the art director, I think it is talking to Billington and saying, look, you know, when we got into trouble was when Gorbachev went over to England and Margaret Thatcher introduced him into Freemasonry. And Billington thinks that's just a hoot. You know, he doesn't believe that, and he puts it down. So you have to watch him.
Well, do you think that Gorbachev did go into Freemasonry, or do you think that that's a true statement?
He probably did. I don't know whether, you know, he got his 33rd degree or whatever, but and then, too, you have to watch Gorbachev. Sometimes he'll just go through the motions. I think he went up to Canada and was meeting with this New Age guru, and so he's putting his feelers out, trying to get this broad base for him. But when you look at what Gorbachev is, you have to look at his own words. So, for example, I have a tape of him where he's saying, cosmos is God.
Right.
So that's where he's coming from. The cosmos is God.
Well, now, is Margaret Thatcher into the occult at all? She's always been an enigma to me.
Well, she is, and I don't know that she is, although Britain and Prince Charles are into those things, you know, the little seances,
sure,
and all that sort of stuff they get into. But Margaret is an enigma in the sense that just a few months ago, around December, she was delivering a speech in Washington, I think at the Heritage Foundation, where she was warning people about this power elite which was trying to do away with American and British sovereignty.
Really? Yeah. Well, you know, maybe, and sometimes, you know, I've heard some of her speeches, it's almost like you're ready for an altar call at the end of them. And, you know, maybe she is that one unique individual who's out there. I know other people who feel very uncertain about her. Certainly they got rid of her, though. They manipulated her out of power when she didn't want to go along with the European Union.
Well, before we get too friendly to her, remember, she's also spoken at the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies, so there's a mixed bag there.
Well, but of course, she spoke at the State of the World Conference, I think,
right,
in 95, but, you know, my friends who were there said that she really took on Gorby at every turn.
Well, good.
She was the only person who really did. So, and, you know, of course, they had the tapes of it and gave us, you know, at least that aspect of it, which was sort of nice to hear. Now, maybe it was good cop, bad cop. I'll have to admit this is one person who still has me very confused. I'll wait until you arrive at a decision before I arrive at mine. Anyway, it's been a fascinating hour. Dr. Cuddy, I really always appreciate the time to talk with you and, of course, to share it with our listeners. And the young man who called in, Mike, really, he spent 20 years in the New Age, and that he came to know the Lord, and so he knows the truth of what you speak of, and the relationship between the New World Order, the economic order, and of course the spiritual, which is the common denominator behind everything. Now, Dr. Ketty has a number of books. We carry one of them. It's called Conspiracy, and then the Secret Orders Revealed. Is that a secret? What is that now? Secrets Revealed,
Records,
isn't it?
Conspiracy, subtitled Secret Records,
right,
Revealed. The
we have
first
that.
Part is a history of the best quotes in their own words, and then the last part is like Edward Bellamy's Looking Backwards, where I go to the year 2100 and look backward to see how Big Brother came into power.
And then, of course, we have the book on Fabianism, Fabian Socialism.
Right.
What's the
title? The Road to Socialism and the New World Order.
All right, we carry that here at Radio Liberty, and then I wish we had the dawning, now is the dawning of the New Age, New World Order. That's a book which really needs to get back in print again. Is that going to be reprinted, you know?
Well, they keep saying they are, but it's several years old now. It was one of the first ones about this subject back when the New World Order term came up.
It is still, you know, I think probably the finest book on that subject out there, with so many good quotations. Well, maybe I'll come into some money sometime and republish it if the previous publisher won't. We'll see. Anyway, thank you so very much for being with us. God bless you, and we'll be talking to you before long.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Dr. Dennis Cuddy by Dr. Stan at Radio Liberty. For other messages available at Radio Liberty, you can contact them by phoning 1-800-795-5225. 844-8927. God bless.